From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Nearly 60 people have been killed and more than 500 injured in the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history on Sunday night, early Monday morning in Las Vegas at a concert. The suspected gunman was a 64-year-old white man named Stephen Paddock, who appeared to have taken his own life by the time law enforcement got to him. He was apparently shooting from the 32nd floor of a hotel into crowds of concert attendees at the three-day-long country music festival at the Mandalay Bay Hotel. So far, there were reports that he used at least one automatic weapon that could have been a military-style assault rifle. Because Paddock was not found as yet to have had any political motivations connected with foreign organizations, he has been dubbed a lone wolf rather than a terrorist. President Donald Trump gave an address on Monday morning calling the shooting, quote, an act of pure evil. He plans to visit Las Vegas on Wednesday after presumably returning from Puerto Rico. When mass shootings happen, the NRA and their right-wing allies often denounce any mentions of gun control as an effort to politicize a tragedy. But if gun control is not raised after a shooting, when should it be raised? So today, as the facts around the horrific Vegas shooting are still emerging, we'll play a recent interview with Dennis A. Hennigan, Director of Legal and Policy Analysis at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, formerly the Vice President of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He spoke with me several months ago about his book, Guns Don't Kill People, People Kill People, and other myths about guns and gun control.
Thank you, Sonali. Good to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, my favorite statement or assertion by the gun proliferation advocates is all you need is a good guy carrying a gun to kill the bad guy with the gun. Every time there's a mass shooting, the response is, well, if the good people were armed, the good guys were armed, they would have prevented the bad guys from killing as many people. And it's just sort of laughable because it seems as though there's this fantasy of a Western, these sort of old style Westerns where everybody is well armed and a straight shot and with perfect ability to kill from afar with a gun, and the person who draws their gun fastest wins, and usually it's the good guys who are going to do that. Are all of these just blatant fantasies?
Well, yes, they are, and unfortunately, they're very dangerous fantasies because they have been allowed to dominate the gun debate in this country, and they persuade far too many people that the solution to gun violence is more guns, when in fact, everything we know about guns and gun violence suggests just the opposite. If you look at the states with the highest incidence of gun ownership, those are the very states with the highest rates of gun deaths. People in those states are not safer. They're actually more exposed to violence and danger. I think the reductio ad absurdum of that argument is the notion that we should allow people on college campuses to carry guns. This is one of the great new crusades of the National Rifle Association. And it happened after the Virginia Tech massacre, when it was speculated that if just one of those students in that classroom had a gun, they could have shot back and ended the massacre. And so the NRA would allow students to carry guns in fraternity houses, to keg parties, to sporting events. They would allow the proliferation of guns on college campuses just to make it possible, in the unlikely event that there is a mass shooter on campus, for somebody to be able to shoot back, not knowing whether they would in fact hit their target at all.
Right, so we know in places like Orlando, Yeah, we know in places like Orlando, for example, that even when the police, who are well trained in the best trained people in the use of firearms, stormed the Pulse nightclub, they may have inadvertently shot some of the people who died. And so this notion that, ordinary ones among us who get some training in shooting will be better shots than the police and be able to stop the bad guys with the guns is just really, really interesting. Now, you mentioned the statistic that the states with the most guns are where we have the most gun deaths. Is the converse true? Do those states who have the strongest gun laws have the fewest gun deaths?
Yes, as a matter of fact, that is the case. And it so happens that states like Hawaii and Massachusetts and New Jersey and New York, which are these are states where there are guns, but there are also very strong gun laws, and they have the lowest rates of gun deaths. Gun violence is a very complex problem. It involves not only homicides, it involves suicides and accidental shootings. But one thing is clear, where there are more guns, there are more gun deaths. Where there are weaker gun laws, there are more gun deaths. And this is also proven internationally. We see other high-income nations across the world that have strong gun laws, fewer guns, and their homicide rates are a tiny fraction of ours. So we can learn from the facts that we know, and we got to get beyond the fantasies, beyond the mythologies, to deal with real facts. And when we do, it shows us a path towards a more peaceful society.
Well, Dennis, how do you respond to the assertion that a lot of gun proliferation activists point to Chicago, one of the cities with the worst rates of homicides in the country, being a city that also has strict gun laws? How does that happen?
Well, it happens because a city like Chicago can pass as many laws as it wants, but those are applicable only within the city limits. The guns that are victimizing poor minority communities in Chicago are not coming from Chicago. They are coming from suburban Chicago gun shops, which are not governed by Chicago's gun laws. They're coming from the South. There is a well-established pattern of gun trafficking from Mississippi right up to Chicago and other cities in the upper Midwest. So all that argues that we need strong gun laws at the federal level. Cities can do what they can, states can do what they can, but guns travel very easily across state and city boundaries. That's why we need a federal solution. But as you have seen in recent history, the Congress is absolutely paralyzed by this issue, even though President Obama is trying to move them forward toward sensible gun policy.
And then the other very standard bumper sticker, which of course gives your book its name, Guns Don't Kill People, People Kill People, is based on this assumption that a criminal will acquire a gun or acquire a kind of weapon, legally or illegally. They'll do what it takes to get their hands on an illegal weapon. So that in a way kind of contradicts what you were saying, when you said that gun trafficking allows people who want to get their hands on guns to get their hands on guns, and yet the same people who say a criminal will get their hands on guns any which way will want to prevent federal gun laws.
Well, I think what that argument misses is that it does make a difference what kind of weapon is in the hands of a dangerous person. Research over decades has shown that attacks with guns are 5 times more deadly than attacks with knives, for example. So guns are simply inherently more lethal, and we can see that. I mean, it's hard to imagine that Orlando killer would have been able to murder 53 people with knives or with baseball bats. Guns are especially well adapted to killing and mass killing. And so there is a difference in the type of weapon that someone uses, and that's why it makes sense to have very strong policies to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people, much stronger policies than we might employ with respect to knives or baseball bats or some other type of weapon.
Dennis, how have how has the NRA and their allies made guns synonymous with freedom? It's just so bizarre that we live in a society that's supposed to be, you know, in a country, the most advanced country in the world, the richest, the most politically powerful country, and yet, you know, guns are apparently equivalent to freedom. How does that happen? How did that happen?
It is surely one of the great propaganda victories of the gun lobby. But in fact, you have to ask yourself, how free really is the ordinary American citizen when we can't send our kids to school without any assurance that they'll be safe? We can't go to a nightclub without any assurance that we'll be safe. You know, just ordinary gun violence on the streets of our cities. I say ordinary because we've become so accustomed to losing so many of our fellow citizens to street violence. The people who live in those neighborhoods do not regard themselves as free in any real sense. So, in fact, the proliferation of guns is enslaving us. It is not making us free. Mm-hmm. And we have to combat this notion that it is.
So what about this notion among people who may not ever want to own an AR-15 assault rifle, but they do want to go hunting? They've got, you know, a gun that one might consider not as lethal. And they think that, well, if you start banning AR-15s, if you start banning these military-style weapons, it's just a matter of time before Obama comes for my gun. How do you respond to that? I mean, that basically prevents us from applying any laws whatsoever.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's the classic slippery slope argument that is so important to the NRA. So you will hear it over and over again. But as you point out, if we fail to take sensible, moderate steps to keep guns out of the wrong hands because of this imagined fear that somehow down the line it's going to lead to confiscation of all guns, we are depriving ourselves of policies that can save lives. You know, the NRA used the same argument against the Brady Bill. It said, look, these background checks are just the first step on the long road to confiscation. Well, if the Congress had listened to that argument when the Brady Bill was being debated, it would have been defeated, and we would not have been able to block over 2 million prohibited gun buyers, most of them felons, from walking into gun shops and buying guns. We've been able to block those sales since Brady was enacted because we didn't listen to that NRA argument. So there's a severe social cost to listening to and crediting the slippery slope argument, and that needs to be realized. It is ridiculous that we cannot draw rational distinctions between policies like background checks, which are not threatening to law-abiding gun owners, they are not threatening to the average hunter. There's a distinction between those kinds of policies and an overall ban on all weaponry. And nobody's talking about an overall ban. They're talking about sensible measures that the NRA uses that slippery slope argument to rally gun owners in opposition to, and that needs to be overcome.
Dennis A. Hennigan is the Director of Legal and Policy Analysis at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, formerly the Vice President of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. His book is called Guns Don't Kill People, People Kill People, and Other Myths About Guns and Gun Control, an issue of great importance in the wake of the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history in Las Vegas. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.